Hi.
Thanks for the revised one page I took.
So, yeah, Terry.
Industry in Rochester. And
okay. Good afternoon. The Senate Judiciary Committee will come to order. Senator Bonhoff, Senate File 2175. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't come before judiciary very often, so.
Always welcome.
Thank you. So, Mr. Chair, members, today, Senate File 2175 is actually in response to something that occurred over the interim. Currently, in state law, we require that MNSCU, before making asset acquisitions, send a letter informing us of that to the Chair of Finance in the Senate and the House Ways and Means Chair, and to copy myself and the Chair of Higher Ed in the House. Over the interim, we received a letter saying that MNSCU intended to purchase the Bates property at $275,000, and upon review, we discovered that the property was actually valued at $125,000, and in addition, that the sale price prior to this being purchased was listed on the Ramsey County Assessor's website for $1. So when we discovered that MNSCU was proposing to pay $275,000, that was of great concern to us. Senator Cohn issued a letter back to MNSCU asking them to come back to us before doing that. But it was not within the authority of the statute to really stop that from happening. That caused us to reflect and determine what might we'd like to do going forward. And I will say, Senator Latz, that MNSCU folks do have a reason why they chose to do that, but that's really not part of the proceedings here today. What's before us today is a bill that simply states that state agencies, and then there is an exemption for MnDOT and the DNR, which already have that in law, but that state agencies would not purchase a property for greater than 10% of the appraised value. In addition, there's a provision in the bill that says that the section requires that the sum of the amounts paid over appraised value must not be more than the sum of the amounts paid under appraised value for a rolling 12 months. So basically, it does give Minsky a little flexibility if they were going to pay a little bit over for one as long as they had built up paying under for others. And that's the way the DNR works. In fact, the DNR is even more expansive. They don't have just in a rolling 12 months. They have a bank where they get to keep all their below and above since the beginning of when they first started that practice.
So Senator Bonoff, appraised value meaning
the license.
What's the benchmark for that?
So it states that the appraised value by an appraiser who holds a state appraiser license issued by the Department of Commerce.
Okay, so at the time of the proposed
purchase.
Transaction,
exactly.
Then an appraiser would go out like in any normal
exactly, like in any purchase,
okay.
Yes.
Irrespective of whatever the assessed value is on the county's
exactly.
Property tax books.
Yes.
All right. Do you have any testifiers that you'd like to present?
No, I do have Susan Damon is here from the DNR in case you had questions, and Greg, I believe Eastness is here from Minsky in case you had questions, but we felt that this was pretty straightforward, so I do not have testifiers.
Okay. So which agencies then are covered here? Because you've got some limitations in the definitions of agency. You say the DNR is not included.
Right, the DNR has been exempt as well as the Department of Transportation.
Otherwise, all other state agencies?
Yes, and Mr. Chair, you know, really not many state agencies are acquiring property, so this was really meant to be for Minsky in particular. It was just because it was originally drafted by the Chair of Ways and Means in the House, he drafted it more broadly. But I do not know of other agencies besides those, and nobody's come forward concerned about that.
All right. Any members of the committee have any questions? Yes, Senator Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator, I had to step out just for a second, so if I miss something, excuse me. But the understanding is you can't purchase a piece of property over 10%
of the appraised value.
Of the appraised value. I'm not a realtor, but isn't my understanding that there are sometimes that something might be appraised and somebody really wants that property and they're willing to bid higher than somebody else, and it goes up, and eventually you get to a point where you you have to be able to bid more if it's that valuable. If it's not that valuable, then you stop bidding. So it feels a little bit like we're trying to stop the process here. And yet I understand we don't want to be outrageous. So I don't know what happened with Minsky on that last building, but does this give enough leeway for people to bid reasonable against somebody else from getting it? Otherwise, we put ourselves kind of behind the ball so that we aren't able to bid on some things if it's valuable out to the general public.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hall. Senator Hall, I don't think that we want our state agencies to be in the practice of paying more than things are at appraised value. I think DNR, and perhaps Susan Damon would come forward, has found this to be a very useful negotiating tool. Not being able to do that, I think that if the state pays an inflated value because they're in a bidding war, perhaps that's not best for taxpayers.
Ms. Damon?
Susan Damon, Land Acquisition and Legal Services Manager with the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources.
Could you pull the mic forward, please? Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members, the DNR is subject to provisions in Minnesota Statutes Section 84.0272, Subdivision 1, and Senator Bonoff's bill is modeled after that law. And the DNR is subject to this limit of 10% above the appraised value, but does have some flexibility that is created by this negotiation bank, that where a sum of the accumulated differences is tracked. And so if we do are in a situation where we do need to offer more than 10% above the appraised value, we can do that as long as we have sufficient funds in that negotiation bank to allow that to happen.
So then the follow-up, I guess, is does this bill provide for that kind of flexibility as well?
Mr. Chair, it does. The difference is our negotiation bank's time period is a rolling 12 months, whereas the DNR, they could book those savings, you know, over 10 years. So they could have a decade of paying under, which would allow them a one-time. We felt it was prudent to have it be within the rolling 12-month basis, and we could certainly revisit this if it turns out that we need more flexibility. But the situation that came before us this fall was one of great concern, and Senator Hall, you didn't I don't know if you understood what exactly happened, but Minsky was offering $275,000 for a building that had been appraised at $125,000. And to be fair, you know, they were trying to build a big parking lot at Metro State, and there was this one abandoned property where the seller wasn't responsive, and so that was a tactic they used. But we would like them to use, have other tools in their toolboxes.
Senator Bonoff, it looks like the language in here provides a hard cap of 10% above the appraised value. And then they can go within that 10%, they can utilize the banked funds to pay. Maybe I'm
no.
Not reading
Mr.
this
Chair, on line 1.22, if the agency pays less than the appraised value for the real property, the difference between the purchase price may be used to apply toward other purchases of real property at more than the appraised value.
Right.
So
but
if they're under, they can go above that 10% threshold using that towards it.
I'm going to ask Ms. Pontius to comment, because that's not the way I'm reading it, Senator Bonoff. It looks like they can use that money to go above the appraised value, but they can't use the money to go above the 10% cap above the appraised value. If your intent is to have that outlet to be able to go more than 10% over the appraised value, that's not, I don't think that's what's in
it. Mr. Chair, that was the intent of the way it was drafted, and previous counsel had told us that was accomplished with the way it's drafted, so if Ms. Pontius does not think that, then I would want to switch that.
Well, let's ask Ms. Pontius to give us her official opinion.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bonoff, I think, initially you've got the 10% limit, mm-hmm. and then going forward you can bank money. So initially you're bound by that 10%. But then let's say if you were to go less than the appraised value, which would be, say 90% or less or whatever, then you could bank that amount going forward.
Mm-hmm.
But initially you would be capped by the 10%.
Well, Mr. Chair, Ms. Pontius, initially you'd be capped at the 10% because you wouldn't have any transactions to have gathered that going under. But what Ms. Pontius is saying, Mr. Chair, is that going forward you could bank that money to go over the 10%.
I'm still having trouble with that concept because there's lines 20 to 22 specifically say the agency must not agree to pay more than 10% above the appraised value. There's nothing in there that says unless they have banked sufficient funds from previous transactions that they have the money available to go above 10%. The next provision just says they can, if they pay less than the appraised value, they can use the difference between the purchase price and the appraised value to apply toward other purchases at more than the appraised value. But it doesn't say that more than appraised value would be within that 10% band as I read it. I don't see anything in here that says they can go more than the 10% over.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Bowman,
I can understand that it's not crystal clear, and so perhaps we should change it to be
more
crystal
than,
clear.
That
really was the intent, and so Ms. Damon is showing me that the way it's written in statute with the DNR language is slightly different. If Ms. Damon would like to read that.
Yeah, please, Ms. Damon, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. The language in 84.0272 states that the Commissioner of Natural Resources may pay less than the appraised value, but shall not agree to pay more than 10% above the appraised value, except that if the Commissioner pays less than the appraised value for a parcel of land, the difference between the purchase price and the appraised value may be used to apply to purchases at more than the appraised value. And our understanding of the legislative intent and our interpretation of this law has been to have this negotiation bank that allows us, if there are sufficient funds in the negotiation bank, to pay more than 10% above appraised value for specific parcels of land.
84, statute, chapter 84. You have it right there.
I didn't hear what number it was.
0.0272. You say 0.0272? Sure. Subdivision 1?
Subdivision 1, that's correct.
Mr. Chair, I'm wondering if we shouldn't insert something, and I'm not certain of the exact language, but if the agency pays less than the appraised value for the real property, the difference between the purchase price and the appraised value may be used to apply toward other purchases of real property at more than the 10% above appraised value. So that you'd actually state in law, in that on 1.24 after the, you'd insert more than the 10% appraised value.
So I'm reading the DNR's language, and that I would submit as a little ambiguously drafted.
Exactly.
Because there's an exception there that only refers back to the appraised value, doesn't specifically refer to 10% above the appraised value. And it sounds like the DNR has been, if I were being asked for my legal opinion, I would say the DNR has been exceeding its statutory authority if you're paying more than 10% over the appraised value. But it is a little ambiguously drafted here. But I'll ask the policy question to follow up. If you're negotiating with a landowner and they know that there's been money that's been banked in the past, and maybe you've banked enough money over whatever period of time to pay twice the appraised value, then your cap is twice the appraised value. So what have you accomplished?
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess what you've done, first of all, that's why we limit it to 1 year. So it would be very unlikely that you would have that kind of built up resources in a quote bank, unlike the DNR, who's there is no time frame around their being able to bank going under. So the 12 months limits that. And then what I would say is that you're counting on the discretion of the personnel who make those decisions to be fiscally prudent. So if they did, you know, negotiate very well and go under in hopes of being able to get a really plum piece and pay more within that 12 months, if they've still protected the state's overall portfolio, so to speak, in terms of cash and value, then I'd say I don't have a problem with that. But I don't want to leave it ambiguous, and so I still would recommend that we insert the more than 10% of the appraised value. Yet if it was this will of this committee to not ever let them go over the appraised value, I would be comfortable with that too. I mean, it feels a little more rigid, but.
Well, and I understand. First tack was to find out exactly what you intended.
Yes.
And whether that matched the language that was in the bill. And then the second question is whether or not that's the direction the committee is comfortable going. Senator Newman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Bonhoff, to the issue that we've been discussing, Mr. Chairman, I agree with your legal analysis as to the hard 10% cap. And I will tell you, Senator Bonhoff, that I really like your bill, down to line 22. And I will tell you that I would not agree to allowing the money that we save to be banked and allow a state agency to then proceed to purchase a subsequent piece of property for more than 10% of the appraised value. And moreover, I am troubled by the language that you are able to bank the savings at all, because it really looks to me like if a state agency is able to save some money, I think that's a real good idea, but then the state agency gets to keep it. And you know, unless I am completely misunderstanding how real estate purchases work, I don't think the state agency should be able to keep the money that they saved. I think that they should purchase the piece of property in accordance with that appraised value and the structure of your bill, and leave it at that.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bono.
I would consider that a friendly amendment. If that was the will of the committee, I would be comfortable with that.
Well, see if there are any other thoughts on the committee. I'm almost thinking while we're at it, no matter what we do, we probably ought to clean up the DNR's language too, because I think there's some someone could challenge some transactions by the DNR under the statutory language that's here, which would not be helpful for the DNR and the titles to some of those property, I suppose.
Mr. Chair, I would hope
Senator
you wouldn't
you don't want to expand
put that
your bill.
On my bill.
Mr. Chair, I have a question.
Senator Dietzick.
I'm tired, so I'm not searching my memory bank as well as I should, but can local governments, I mean, they can't bank money and just buy whatever, because I can envision, and I can give you an example of where we had three properties that originally agreed to buy out or be purchased, and two of them were, they were very willing sellers, and they just wanted out of the market, and so they went for less. And then, quite frankly, the third one, once they realized it was a government entity buying the property, decided they wanted three times the appraised value. And so in this situation, had they known the previous two went for less than the appraised value, or they actually went for less than the market value because they were dilapidated buildings, they could have easily then, it might have worked, but they were still above the 10%. They were going for three times the appraised value, so they were way above the 10%. But I can see in that situation where they would have continued to hold the entity hostage by saying, we know you have this much money because you didn't pay the, quote, appraised value on the previous two houses. So I can see where there could be games being played in just the order of which you purchase property. So I'm somewhat concerned about that. And I thought I saw Patrick Hines here somewhere. I mean, what do local governments, do they have? I don't think they can go above a certain amount when they're doing stuff. Am I correct? Yeah, I don't think local governments can go above a certain amount. There's Mr. Hines.
I don't know if anyone in the room knows what restrictions, if any, there are on local governments on that. Ms. Pontius tells me she doesn't have any specific knowledge. Seen the League of Minnesota Cities is waving their head. No, they don't know.
I don't think they.
Do you know? And you, if you don't, tell us you don't. That's okay.
Yeah, I don't think they can.
Mr. Chair, members, Patrick Hines of the League of Minnesota Cities. Thank you, Senator Dietzick, for the opportunity to testify.
Sorry.
I don't believe there is a restriction on a local unit of government for that purchase price. I will double-check to make sure that that's the case, but I don't believe that there is.
For what it's worth, my recollection of when we did these things on the city council in St. Louis Park, we didn't have any statutory caps. You do have the issue of the holdout,
Yeah.
As you're trying to acquire a series of properties for one redevelopment. But it's hard to avoid that.
Right. I was just going to say, I understand that there needs to be some flexibility because sometimes the appraised value, I mean, there's just so many different market situations that impact it. So I understand having some flexibility to go above the appraised value, but I'm concerned about the banking issue. And so I can't remember specifically what Senator Newman said, but I think I tend to agree with what he said.
Mr. Chair, I think, in keeping with what Senator Newman and Senator Disick said, you would just delete everything after the period on line 1.22.
Keep that sentence there.
I'll keep the last sentence. The only other way I could think of to try to sort of split the difference here would be to give some flexibility over the 10% for maybe another 10% if there's some kind of substantial showing that it's necessary to accomplish the project goals or something like that. But I'm not sure how you force that. That'd be pretty difficult to end up in court with whether or not a showing has been made.
Right. I was wondering about giving some discretion for a waiver to the Commissioner of MMB, if that interests the committee. That's the only other thing I thought about.
Thoughts, Senator Newman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Bonhoff, I don't know whether that idea would work or not, but I am fairly certain that in terms of negotiations for the purchase of real estate, the market is going to be what the market is. So I'm not sure that I would support that idea. I will tell you, Senator Bonhoff, that if you wish a motion to delete the lines, I will make that motion, but I will not do it unless you are in agreement with it.
Mr. Chair, Senator Newman, I am in agreement.
With that understanding, Mr. Chairman, I would move to delete everything after the period beginning on line 22.
1.22?
Yeah, 1.22 through the balance of the...
Except for that last sentence.
I think I've got that.
Senator
right.
Newman, could we ask you to exempt from your motion on line 2.4 everything after the first period? That last sentence should probably stay in.
I agree, Mr. Chairman, and I would agree with that.
So the motion is by Senator Newman on line 22, delete everything after the period, delete lines 23, 24, 2.1, 2.2, 2.3, and 2.4 through the first period.
So moved.
Any further discussion? Senator Bonhoff, use this as a friendly amendment.
Mr.
Senator
Chair.
Hall, it doesn't address the concern you just raised.
No, I do want to know, what does it do to leave that last line in?
I suppose since the benchmark is the appraisal, if there was some dispute over whether the appraisal they're using as their reference point is adequate, they could seek a new appraisal at the discretion of the agency.
Okay, if that's what it does. Okay. Good.
But it doesn't address the issue of...
No, and I'm okay.
The market going higher and higher because someone's...
I like
this
better.
That's just what the price is. You like this better. Okay.
And Mr. Chairman, there are a variety of reasons why a potential buyer would seek, more than one appraisal. So I don't see any problem with that at all.
All right. Seeing no further discussion, Senator Newman's motion to amend Senate File 2175. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Any further discussion on this Senate file? Anyone else in the audience wish to be heard? Not seeing anyone. Senator Newman wish to move the bill? Senator Newman moves that Senate file 2175 as amended be recommended to pass and be re-referred or sent to the Senate Commerce Committee. That's what we have down here. You aware of that?
Mr.
Commerce requested it.
Oh, we didn't get a referral request.
You didn't get notice of that?
No.
Then I'll tell you what we'll do. Why don't we lay the bill on the table for a little bit here? We'll contact the Commerce Committee and find out if they really do wish to see it.
Thank you.
And we'll decide how to handle it once we get some information from them.
So, Mr.
We'll try
Chair,
to do that yet this
will you
today.
Need me to stay until you get that?
Well, that's up to you. If you want to weigh in on whatever they have to say, or we can give the information to you when we get it before we bring the bill back up, and you can, if you don't like what you hear, you can go talk to Commerce about it.
Okay, thank
before.
You.
But we'll leave this on the agenda. Well, we'll just lay it on the table at the Chair's initiative right now. We can take it back up today, or we can take it back up later this week, depending on what information we get and how much time you'd like to respond.
And,
to
Mr.
It.
Chair, if it didn't go to Commerce, then it would just be in finance to be referred to the floor.
Does it have a finance?
No. So it would just go to the floor.
Then it wouldn't go to finance at all.
Yeah. I thought it would be going to the floor, so...
I can see you were surprised by the information we have. So we'll lay it on the table for right now. You
Mr. Chair.
Yes. Senator Bonneau.
I guess my committee administrator's understanding was it would go to finance because Senator Cohen was going to see it.
Okay. Well, that'll be the fallback position, but right now we have to sort out what may have been a request from Commerce.
Thank you.
So Senate File 2175 is laid on the table. Senate File 2555, Senator Eaton.
Let's see.
Okay, members, we're going to hand out a delete everything amendment that is new, replacing the one that's in your packet.
It deletes the delete everything?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, so members of the audience, the new delete everything amendment, the A2, is the one that's in the accordion at the end of the table. So while this is being handed out, this is an author's amendment, this being the committee, the bill's first committee. So Senator Sharon moves adoption of the A2 author's amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails. Amendments adopted. Senator Eaton, tell us what your bill is about.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My bill is about homeowner association boards. Estimated 20 to 25% of Minnesota homeowners live within a common interest community, and these communities are regulated by over 7,000 separate homeowner association boards, most of which are comprised of volunteer board members with no special expertise in solar energy. Unfortunately, in most cases, the homeowner association board has no clear process for permitting rooftop solar. This leads to confusion, conflict, and in some cases, lawsuits. Following the 2013 establishment of Minnesota's solar energy standard, we expect to see a 30-fold increase in solar energy over the next 6 years, including residential rooftop solar. So now is the time to establish clear and fair rules for homeowners and their homeowner association boards. These boards are governed by state and federal law, which sets the legal boundaries within which they operate. State and federal law also regulate the content, formation, and enforcement of private contracts in general. And Senate File 2553 would establish boundaries for homeowner associations and land-related contracts when it comes to rooftop solar for homeowners who have the responsibility for their own roof. At least 22 states, including Colorado, Illinois, and Wisconsin, have already taken this step and adopted statutes that help balance the interests of both the homeowner and their neighbors. Senate File 2553 balances these by providing homeowners who own and are solely responsible for their own roof a clear and fair process for securing homeowner association approval of rooftop solar energy systems. And that's subdivisions 2 and 3. And the interests of their neighbors, it respects and affirms the important role that homeowner associations play in guaranteeing that an individual property owner does not harm their neighbors. You should have a one-page description of the bill, which lists authorities granted to the Homeowners Association under this bill at Subdivision 4. And this bill all furthers important state goals, including the newly adopted 2020 Solar Energy Standard and the 2030 goal for solar deployment. This bill helps our state meet these goals at a lower cost by establishing fair rules that are clear and predictable. I'd like to point out I'm not a lawyer. I'm a registered nurse, but I did bring Ross Abbey, policy associate with Fresh Energy, with me today to help answer any questions about the particulars.
Is Mr. Abbey a lawyer?
Yeah, I graduated JD Chicago Law 2005.
Okay, well, then you can testify.
Yeah, really.
Despite the fact that it was Chicago. Just kidding. Let me ask a question before you do, if I may. We've got a handout here that talks about, you know, all the stakeholders being consulted, and we've got the Delete Everything Amendment, which I presume is a result of consultations with the stakeholders. Could you identify the stakeholders and whether or not you believe you have agreement from all of them on the proposal before us?
Certainly. For the record, my name is Ross Abbey. I'm a policy associate with Fresh Energy. We're a nonprofit that works in the clean energy space. For the last two or three months, we've had extensive engagement with the primary stakeholder has been Community Associations Institute, the Minnesota chapter of a national organization. We had a number of meetings, including I think we had eight attorneys in one room with the House author hashing out some of these things. And yes, the Delete All amendment that you see today, or that has been adopted, as well as two earlier amendments, were in response to concerns and issues they've raised. And we really are trying to have a bill that is a win-win, clear rules of the road, that still provides HOA boards with the flexibility to prevent bad projects, ugly projects, et cetera.
Right. So it's your understanding that all of the stakeholders support the A2 Delete Everything amendment that we have?
Forgive me, I should also mention Common Interest Community Minnesota has been instrumental in helping us kind of craft this bill. CAI, I mentioned earlier, actually has a national policy that they're opposed to any efforts to legislate, you know, anything that would impact HOAs. I think they are opposed to the bill. But at the same time, we can say, and we said with them, we think we've addressed all their legitimate concerns. And it's been really good, actually, to work with them directly to try to understand homeowner associations, understand their needs, and try to craft this bill.
Thank you. Senator Goodwin?
Thank you. And I apologize if you just asked this question. I was talking about trying to get my bill done over here. Senator Eaton, I like your bill a lot. What I'm wondering about, because I live in a townhouse association, if the subdivision 3 here, 1.27, it says it only applies for the dwelling owners responsible for repair, replacement, insurance of the roof. Now, there's very few associations where the owner is responsible. Most of the time, it's the association that's responsible, and it's paid through the association dues. So that would not apply to hardly any people in that case. The owner is responsible for paying association dues, and I don't know by default if that works, but certainly if the owner is got to be the one that, like, we're responsible for our inside work but not for our outside work. So this really wouldn't apply to too many places at all, if I'm reading it right. Can you tell me if I'm reading that right?
Chair, Senator Goodwin. Yeah, as Senator Eaton mentioned, we think there's over 7,000 HOAs in the state. We think there's over 7,000 HOAs in the state. That's the estimate from CAI. In trying to craft a bill that balances both sides, we identified, for townhomes particularly and multifamily, it's often the situation where the HOA is responsible for insuring the roof. And in that case, the concern was that if you put solar up and you do it bad, that could potentially raise the insurance costs for all homeowners as part of the association. And so this bill does not apply to HOAs, all HOAs. It only applies to those where the homeowner owns their own roof and is also responsible for the repair, replacement, and insurance of the roof. Mm-hmm. That may cover about 1,000 HOAs is the rough estimate. The main category of HOAs that we cover is neighborhoods where you've got single-family homes on single-family lots mm-hmm. And townhomes where the individual does insure their own roof.
Thank you.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. Just some thoughts on Senator Eaton's bill. Understand that the way homeowners association rules are adopted, normally what happens is a developer or a private owner comes in and decides that they are going to build condominiums or townhouses or whatever the case might be. And in the course of that, develop rules and regulations regarding a homeowners association. And so what we're really dealing with here, in my estimation, is private property rights. And a bill in which Senator Eaton is requesting that the state come in and impose its will on the private property rights of an owner of real estate. I would also bring to your attention that in terms of the stakeholders that are at the table, I really don't think the contractors are here, and I don't think private property owners are here. If you note where it says the problem addressed on the handout, it says there is no clear process for a homeowner who applies for approval. I don't think that's necessarily true. In every homeowners association rules and regulations that I have ever seen, there is a very clear process that the homeowners can go through after the developer has adopted the rules and sold the various homes, where the rules can be amended. And again, that is a private property right that the homeowners of that particular association have. And if they decided that they wanted to adopt rules which would comply with this Senate file, they have a right to do that. But I really question whether or not it's a good idea for us to impose a state regulation, a state statute, on these private property rights. That is a concept that I am not willing to go forward, particularly given the fact that the folks who own the homes that we are talking about have every right in the world to adopt the homeowners association rules and incorporate these ideas if they choose to do so.
Senator Newman, I actually have a question for you then, because the bill is striking me as trying to balance two sometimes competing private property rights or interests. The private property rights collectively of the homeowners association on behalf of all of the property owners that make up that HOA, sometimes competing with the private property rights of the individual homeowner who's a member of the homeowners association that may wish to do something that the HOA as a collective has not specifically authorized. And so how does your approach balance perhaps those two competing private property rights? If I own a townhome and I want to put solar panels on my roof, I would assert that my private property rights should allow me to do that as long as it doesn't, unduly interfere with or cause damage to the other townhome owners in the HOA.
The answer, Mr. Chairman, to your question is at the time that the buyer is purchasing the real estate, either by way of a title opinion or by way of title insurance, the prospective buyer is notified of the rules and regulations of the homeowners association. And at that time, the buyer will decide whether or not he wishes to enter into the purchase of real estate, which is subject to these conditions contained in the homeowners association. So the prospective buyer knows before they purchase the property that these restrictions are on the property and on the land, and it's very, very common to have all kinds of restrictions on property that the developer and the members of that current homeowners association have a right to do, but always a prospective buyer would know about those restrictions going into the purchase and accept them prior to closing.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Eaton.
Thank you. I do have a homeowner here who would like to testify.
Please. Go ahead, sir.
My name is Michael Wojak. I live at 984 Fox Knoll Drive Southwest, Rochester, Minnesota, and I'm here to tell you a little bit about my background and my experiences. And mostly, I'd be happy to answer any questions you have as well, but my background, I have a dual master's degree in electrical engineering and business administration from the University of Minnesota. I have experience as an electrical engineer with IBM, Hitachi, worked here and in Japan, went into banking for a while. In 2008, birth of my first daughter, I have two children now. I got out of the high-income fields and did something I think I'd enjoy a little bit more, and went into business for myself, doing financial services for churches and nonprofits. I also, that year, opted to run for the Rochester City Council and was fortunate enough the voters decided to give me a shot, and I've been there for the last 6 years. I serve as the... I'm on the Rochester Public Utilities Utility Board. I am currently the chair of the Rochester Olmsted Council of Governments. I represent Ward 2 in the city of Rochester. And I also serve with the National League of Cities as the national vice chair of their Community and Economic Development Board. I'm here today strictly as a citizen on some of my own personal issues. And what I want to do is I want to take you back to 2006, my wife and I were dual income, no kids. It was a fun time to think back about that. We love our children, but that was a very different time for us. And we decided we were going to
build on the public record, sir, just so you know. Every word's being recorded for
posterity. I love my girls to death. And by the way, the oldest is in kindergarten now, so God bless full day kindergarten. Back in 2006, and I think this speaks to some of Senator Newman's comments as well, we were looking to build a home, and we are fans of kind of the new urbanism style, so we wanted to find some place with, that was fitting of the, the walkable lifestyle that we were looking for. And one of my interests with my background in energy and finance was to make sure that we could build a home that in the future we could put solar panels on. So what we did is we carefully selected a site, carefully selected an architectural design such that we had a south-facing roof at the perfect pitch for solar installation in the future, and very, very carefully looked over those covenants and restrictions that we had as a result of being part of this homeowners association, and unquestionably, beyond any shadow of a doubt, there was no mention of any restriction whatsoever on solar. Zero, zip, nada, nothing there. Move forward a few years now. We opt at this point to, we've looked into solar where there's some rebates out there. We decided the time is right, we're going to add solar to our property. There are no covenants guiding solar in our neighborhood association. We have we don't feel that there's any process set up. There's no clear process that exists for how you would submit something like this because it's just not covered by our covenants. There is no process out there for us to reference whatsoever. We have different opinions of what that process might have been should there have been one, but there's no guidance on solar at all. We begin the process of doing solar. And before this, because we want to be decent neighbors, we take the time to go and talk with our immediate neighbors on both sides, tell them, hey, this is what we're thinking about doing. Here's what it's going to look like. One side they can see it, the other side they're close to us, so it impacts them a little bit. What do you folks think about this? Both neighbors, absolutely enthusiastic supporters of what we were doing. As the process begins, we get a notification. Well, not a notification, but somebody from the association comes over and says, hey, we think you need to apply to do this. We very much disagree. However, out of respect for our neighbors and the fact that we live with these people, we do take the time and we submit an application for architectural review to our neighborhood association. In writing, provide them the full construction documents, everything that's going to look like. Prior to this, we've gone through all the permitting process with the city using a qualified installer. Now, what happens next, and my wife, I should mention, is the board secretary for both the Architectural Review Committee and the Neighborhood Association. Per our bylaws, they cannot meet, they cannot discuss these topics, they cannot even take any action whatsoever without having a board meeting, which absolutely requires her to be present. The next thing that happens is this proceeds. We hear nothing back. The solar is installed. The process is finished a couple of weeks later. The next notification that we got, supposedly from the Neighborhood Association, was the letter telling us that we're being sued. We think we've done everything right. We end up in litigation. My wife, who is a board member, was involved in no process of reviewing our application or initiating a lawsuit or even discussing our application. This has huge impacts for my family. Right now, I don't know, between the two sides, we're probably out to some $20,000. Absolutely ridiculous. I've got some pictures that I'm willing to provide to show you exactly what the solar panels look like. From straight on, they do not face the street. They face one side, and the homeowner that they face is more than happy. No one else even has a view of it. It's absolutely ridiculous. There's no guidance in our covenants. There's no guidance in state law. This bill helps address some of these issues. They would have protected my family. And I got to tell you, as being a local elected official, I've been through these contentious issues a number of times. I've been sued in my official capacity before. I've been through this, but my wife, she hasn't been through this. She hasn't signed up for this. And when my wife has to cry herself to sleep over something that we think that was good for the community, good for the environment, and we think we did everything right, that's ridiculous, and that's why I'm here to support this bill.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr.
Wojcik.
Wojcik.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Newman.
Thank you. If I may respond, members. The unfortunate incident that has just been described by Mr. Wojcik really doesn't have anything to do with solar energy. What it has to do with is how the particular homeowners association rules and regulations that he is dealing with, how they are written. We could just as easily be dealing with rules and restrictions say, parking an RV. If there are no rules and regulations on parking an RV and a homeowner wanted to park one, that could be the issue that comes to pass. And while I am sympathetic to what Mr. Wojcik has said, I would be astounded if there isn't written into the rules and regulations of his homeowners association a method of addressing the issue. And it may be a lawsuit, it may be arbitration, it may be homeowners association meetings and votes, but there is a procedure in that homeowners association, and I've never seen one that has ever been adopted by a homeowners association that doesn't have a procedure available for the owners of the homes, the members of that association, to address problems as they come up.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you. Senator Eaton, I'm looking at this handout that you have, and in the handout under the section that says under the bill, the first line says an HOA may not prohibit solar energy systems, whether it's photovoltaic or solar hot water. And I'm looking at the photo that's attached on the front page, and could you tell me, is that a photovoltaic or is that hot water? Do we know?
Mr. Ross.
Chair, Senator Limmer, that's solar photovoltaic.
Photovoltaic?
Yes.
All right. If I remember, and I don't study hot water solar systems, I remember selling real estate. I remember some of the early models that, well, let's just face it, they were just plain ugly. Mm-hmm. They were ramped up at an angle. They had big pipes, PVC pipes that are white in color, which would stand out in stark contrast to a dark roof. A lot of times they would rust over the years. And from a marketing standpoint, those of us in real estate would say, why don't you have it removed if you want a good price on your home? And I think some homeowner associations might consider some of these things not attractive to the eye, and it would diminish the value of the neighboring property. I notice there's no liability in here for that effect if the values of the neighboring properties were diminished because of an unsightly thing hanging on a roof. And so I was wondering, in the 8-attorney meeting that you mentioned earlier, was who represented, who were the representatives there, or who were those 8 attorneys representing in your meeting?
Mr. Abbey.
Chair, Senator Limmer, Common Interest, Community Association Institute, they can't claim to represent all HOAs, but HOAs that are professionally managed, those professional management companies, as I understand it, are members of CAI. Common Interest Communities Midwest, which is, underneath the Minnesota Multifamily Housing Association, they represent another, I guess, subset of homeowner associations. To your point, this did come up, and I think our bill actually does address it in two ways. One, the homeowner association, when they get the application, as part of their design review process, they can mark it up, they can change the project, as long as it fits the allowable conditions enumerated in the bill. And in addition, the bill says they can do any other reasonable restrictions. And that could be anything. So if it's necessary to redo the project to improve the aesthetics, the homeowner association can do that. The bill has a safe harbor. If those changes don't increase the cost or decrease the estimated production of the system by more than 10%, then those changes, whatever they are, presumed reasonable. If the HOA has to go above that 10% bumpers, then I suppose you might have a dispute with the homeowner whether or not those modifications are reasonable. In that case, it might go to arbitration or a judge. Part of the bill I'd point to is line 2.2, and it actually starts on 2.1. The HOA can require the owner or installer of a solar energy system to indemnify or reimburse the HOA or its members for loss or damage caused. I'm actually not aware of any instances where resale value was decreased using modern technology of your neighbors, but if there was a claim for damage, I think this is where it would come in.
Mr. Chair, Senator Eaton, under your bill, an HOA, is it true that an HOA cannot flat out refuse the installation of a hot water or a photovoltaic system on a roof of a property?
Senator Eaton.
My understanding, as long as they follow these rules, the owner does, that is true.
So, Mr. Chair, if they establish certain criteria outlined by your bill, they cannot say no to this, regardless of whether or not 99% of the other shareholders in the HOA do not want it. Are they caught in a bind here, or is there liability for them if they do that? How do we balance the interests of a community who 99% may not want that in their community? Do they have any say or ownership in stating that?
Senator Eaton.
I would refer.
Mr. Abbey.
Chair, Senator Limmer. I guess I want to maybe start with the premise of your question, which is if 99% of the homeowners are opposed to it, solar is a good thing. It increases property values. It's an investment for a suburban home. It might be $25,000, $30,000 investment in the home. It also reduces the homeowner's energy bills. It allows that homeowner to access tax credits, some of which expire in 2016 at the federal level, utility incentives. And the modern systems do look very good. And as we said, aesthetics is addressed under this bill. But it does give the individual homeowner, it gives them the right, if they so choose, to spend that money. And if their homeowner, if their neighbors don't like it, they can write up the project. They can change the tilt of the angles, potentially change what side of the roof it's on, the size of the system. They can prevent it from going above the peak of the roof or beyond the edges. They can require that the HOA be listed on the certificate of insurance. They can require there to be a professional installer. They can require that the systems meet applicable certification standards. But they can't just say no. That's what this bill would do.
Mr. Chair, this reminds me of an earlier bill that we talked about a few years ago, and that was whether or not a owner of a townhome in an HOA was allowed to display an American flag outside their unit, or how big that flag pole would be, or is it something that attaches to the house? And if I remember right, I think we kind of defaulted on what does the original contract in the HOA that they bought into stated. And there should be a kind of a buyer beware of, that's why we give 10 days to read the rules and regulations and bylaws of that association. And I understand that.
Mr. Chair?
And there are limits, on flag display. But I'm just trying to figure out how we balance the interests of an existing contract with something that's new and something, despite the fact that it might be more energy efficient, I'm not sure if it necessarily trumps an existing contract.
Senator Limmer, I'll just remind you, Subdivision 3 in the bill also limits it to single-family dwellings attached or detached where the dwelling owner is responsible for.
Right.
Senator Goodman. Tell me, maybe counsel can tell me, but I read it here that the association does have the right to say no. And in line 1.19, it says that they basically have to do it except for what's provided below. And what's provided below is if approval by a private entity is required for the installation, the application must be processed and approved in the same manner as approval for an architectural modification. That's not a simple process in a townhouse either to get any kind of architectural modification. So the way I'm reading this is that the homeowners association could decide not to approve of it. There's no penalty if they don't do it here. It's just they have to do it within a certain amount of time or it's automatic within 60 days. So am I reading that correctly? So I don't really think we're imposing a must on them.
Ms. Pontius?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Goodman, I read that paragraph B as more of a process provision. And then you have to go down to the allowable conditions, which is really what the accept as provided in this section refers to. So otherwise, I think the operative language is which on page 1, line 18, which is may not prohibit or refuse to permit except as provided in this section.
Except as provided, right. So the exception, wouldn't the exception be 1.20 to 1.26?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Goodwin, that just is referring to the process that they have to follow in terms of timing. But the conditions are actually in Subdivision 4.
Confusing.
Senator Limmer, you have the statute in front of you that refers to the American flags, right?
Right.
As I understand it, we did prohibit the Homeowners Association from banning the display of American flags,
That's correct.
Okay. So one might argue we infringed on private property rights of the Homeowners Association in that statute several years ago.
Well, that may be true, Mr. Chair, but there's quite a difference between a flag waving in the breeze as compared to some of the systems that might be considered unsightly and diminish the value of a neighboring property.
Free speech. And flag poles, right?
I think there was a reference to a flag pole.
But Mr. Chair,
you brought up the topic of the flags. I didn't bring it up. So there at least was one exception not the same circumstances exactly, but at least one exception.
Well, Mr. Chair, a 3x5 flag blowing in the wind is far different than a multi-$1,000 mechanical system sitting on a roof.
Fair question, but I don't know what your point was in raising the exception that's in the
Well, we did have, I was reminding the committee of the discussion we had regarding the struggle of putting something into and trumping an existing contract between a buyer who had 10 days to read the rules and regulations of a homeowner association and signs a document saying that they not only have read it but understood it, with the desire to change the terms of that homeowner association for their own personal use, contrary to the rules and regulations that they bought into.
All right. I know there was a Brian Ross had also signed up to testify. Is Mr. Ross here? Do you wish to be heard on it? Just available to answer questions if we wish. Okay. Senator Hall?
I'll let that pass.
Okay. Now, I think we're going to try to bring this discussion to a close.
You could get this. Yeah. So, Mr. Chair.
Senator Goodwin.
I hate to argue or disagree with our exceptionally intelligent counsel, but I still see in here that in 1.21, it says the application for approval must be processed and approved in the same manner as an application for approval of an architectural modification. Now, anybody that lives in a townhome association understands that an architectural modification is very difficult to get to the outside of a structure. So that tells me that they can process it and approve it or not approve it in the same manner they would do to any other architectural modification. It sounds to me like it still gives them the authority to reject it if they are determined to do that.
Senator Sherman.
In general rule, though, it's notwithstanding, and if notwithstanding means in spite of any covenant. So regardless if there's covenants or restrictions or conditions contained in a deed, et cetera, it says.
But it says
clearly,
except as provided in this section. And then it describes the section.
Senator Goodwin.
I'm sorry.
It says may not prohibit or refuse to permit installation, maintenance, or use of roof mounted, and that's the intent of the author here.
But except as provided in the section, and then it describes the section. That is the key. That is the key part of that, because then it describes the exception, and the exception would be that it has to be processed and approved the same way an architectural modification would.
Well, to make it crystal clear, there would be perhaps two ways to do this. One would be to add a line at the end of 1.26, a sentence that says something to the effect of approval shall not be denied for a proposal or an application that meets the criteria set forth in Subdivision 4.
So that would be a friendly amendment.
If the requirements in Subdivision 4 are adopted as a part of the Homeowners Association rules and regulations.
Senator Lutz, I think that that it's important to have the language clearly express the intent of the author, And then it's clear for all of us as to what we're voting on, which gets down to whether or not we will allow this or any further direction to a homeowners association about what they can and cannot allow. That's the central question here, which Senator Newman has been talking about. So we should be absolutely clear when we vote on this that we're voting for interfering with homeowners associations in this particular instance or not.
Well, then, would someone propose an amendment on line 1.26 as I just described to try to make that crystal clear?
What would it say again, Mr. Chair?
It would say that the application shall not be denied if the application meets the criteria set forth in subdivision 4, if said criteria are part of the Homeowners Association rules and regulations. So if the HOA adopts the allowable conditions provisions, which they would be allowed to do, then if the application meets those conditions, then the HOA has to grant the approval that's requested.
Senator Eaton says yes, so I will move that amendment.
Okay. Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chair, a discussion. I'd like to go back to that reference to the eight attorneys in the room that were before this. The owners that represented the, not the owners, the attorneys who represented these homeowner association membership. Are they anywhere in the room that could give comment to this amendment that's before them?
Anyone in the room wish to be heard on this proposal? Anyone at all wish to testify in opposition to this proposal? Are you coming up to testify, sir?
Sure.
All right. Mana, please identify yourself for the record.
Good afternoon. My name is Nick DiGiulio, and I am part of CAI Minnesota. And I am not a lawyer, but I cannot speak for my clients that we would support this. I know this does have another stop. And first of all, we want to thank Senator Eaton and Fresh Energy for listening to a number of our concerns with this latest A2. Which I think is our third stab kind of at this. A number of the issues have been addressed, but CAI Minnesota has a legislative action committee, and they'd have to kind of sign off on the amendment, but we're willing to keep working with the authors. That makes it better for you guys.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Maybe I can ask a question that can help me. The way the amendment, the oral amendment that we're considering, starts out, an application cannot be denied. Is that something that homeowner associations would think is a friendly amendment?
Chair, Senator Limmer. I think by looking at the allowable conditions, I would assume so, but I'd have to get back to you on that.
Mr. Chair,
Mr. DiGiulio, if the intent of the amendment is to implement what was your understanding of Senator Eaton's purpose of the bill,
mm-hmm.
if we assume that, we can noodle around the language if we need to, but if we assume that to be the intent, is it your position that that amendment would be acceptable for purposes of advancing that original intent to the extent that your association can stand here in support or opposition to any particular bill?
Chair Letts, I think that would be fine.
Thank you. Senator Limmer?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Who is he representing?
Mr. Chair, Mr. DiGiulio?
Correct.
This bill, if it's passed today, will go on to other steps. I'm not sure where it's going to go, but in the event that this amendment gets passed onto this bill, could you check with your clientele, your organizations you represent, and get a written statement from them that they are in favor of that particular amendment or not, and then send it to our offices, mine in particular, and I can distribute it to the other members.
Yep, I can talk with them and check in on that for you.
All right, that'd be helpful. Thank you.
All right,
Senator Latz.
Senator Sharon.
This last discussion with the testifier and has confused me because I thought this amendment, the only intent of this amendment is to make it absolutely clear what the intent of Senator Eaton is, which is that the Homeowners Association cannot deny a solar energy system, cannot deny a solar energy system if it meets the conditions established under Subdivision 4. So all that does is make it clear what we're voting for or against. It doesn't really change what I think this group was opposed to in the first place, which is changes in the association's authority. So I don't want him to be confused about what this amendment does.
Mr. DiGiulio, is that your understanding?
Yep, yes.
Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chair and Senator Sharon, if that is what they, if they originally intended, then we shouldn't have any problem, or they shouldn't have any problem in confirming the use of this amendment.
Fair enough. Senator Sharon, do you wish to offer the amendment?
No.
I think I already did. I made the motion to offer your oral amendment.
Okay.
Is that
what I have described? Yeah, but
what you have described.
The motion because I'm chair.
Yes.
So. Okay. Senator Goodwin moves. Actually, let me have Ms. Pontius has written up some clearer language.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members, just on page 1, line 26, after the period insert, an application must be approved unless it fails to comply with allowable conditions under Subdivision 4.
Senator Goodwin makes that motion. All those in favor say aye.
Mr. Chairman.
Aye.
I'm sorry. Before the vote, I didn't see your hand, Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick observation on the amendment. It was my understanding that the purpose of the bill was to mandate the installation of solar panels.
If they met these conditions.
If the purpose of the amendment now is to remove that mandate or to prohibit a homeowners association from requiring it, maybe is a better way to put it. I really don't see the purpose of the amendment or the bill.
Mr. Chair, I don't think that
Senator Goodwin.
That's what this amendment is doing at all. I think this amendment is clarifying what Senator Eaton thought she already had in her bill, and that is to provide for allowing solar energy.
But, Mr. Chairman,
maybe we should ask you, Mr. Chair, what or counsel, what does this amendment actually do?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Newman.
If the homeowners associations can right now require the installation of solar panels within their homeowners association if they want to, you simply put it into the rules and regulations of the homeowners association. And if that is the case, and I believe that folks have got a right to contract in any manner that they want. If that's the case, why do we need the bill?
Senator Newman, I think the point of the bill was that individual homeowners wish to be able to install solar panels despite the opposition of the Homeowners Association. And that was the purpose of the bill, and that's the intent of the amendment, is to clarify that the Homeowners Association cannot deny an individual homeowner's application to make that installation if the Homeowners Association except to the extent that they can require these allowable conditions in September 4, or in Subdivision 4.
Mr. Chairman.
Which would implement the intent of the author. And then you know, it'll be up to the committee, as Senator Sharon said, to decide whether that policy is one that the committee wishes to pass judgment, you know, pass or not.
It's two motions.
But for clarification of the language, because of the Senator Goodwin's question about does the language really do what it is that the author is intending to do, the amendment is intended to clarify the language for that purpose only.
And Mr. Chair?
Senator Goodwin.
I just want to remind people this only applies to a small fraction of the association type dwellings because it only applies to those that own their own roof and pay their own insurance and have to repair their own roof if repairs are needed. So that's just a tiny fraction of those of us that live in townhomes or multiple dwellings, not very many. The reason I favor this bill is because once they own all that, they should be able to do that. It's very different than the association basically owning all the exterior and so forth. Very different. Because we don't have to pay for our roofs if they leak, and they did, and we've had them replaced twice. But that's out of the whole association dues. But this person would have to pay for their own new roof if there was damage or whatever. So that only applies to a small fraction. It doesn't apply to all the associations.
Okay. Any other questions on this particular amendment? Senator Hall.
Well, yeah, it relates. Senator Goodwin, would you also agree that we should not keep cities or towns from allowing homeowners to put solar systems on their roofs if the city ordinance has a ordinance against it?
Mr. Chair,
Senator Goodwin.
Senator Hall, yeah, I would. I'd say we shouldn't allow them to.
And so you would
Senator
want,
Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, you would want the state to override the city in those situations,
on
not
that
local
situation,
control.
I would. Goodwin. For energy efficiency, you bet.
Just for energy efficiency, I see.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Reed?
Mr. Havey, you'd like to make a clarifying statement about the language?
Before you do, Mr. Havey, I'll just point out that there is a provision in line 2.16, the bill that says the energy system must meet standards and requirements imposed by state and by governmental units. So I'm not sure that that would allow an outright prohibition, but at least would allow local governmental units to set standards. Mr. Abbey.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Pertinent to the oral amendment, which I think does clarify the intent, there is, so as we discussed, the HOA can impose a number of conditions. It can also impose additional reasonable restrictions, including up to 10% cost increase, 10% production decrease, or even above that if required, if it's reasonable. And so there is a scenario where the HOA goes through the process, redoes the project, and the homeowner says, well, I don't want to go forward with the project under what you've given me, or maybe I can't afford it this time. And so there is a process whereby if it's a really ugly system or it just doesn't belong in there, that the HOA can make those changes. But that's different than saying no. Or not even giving an answer to the homeowner.
All right. So the question before us right now is the amendment. So if this bill were to go forward, should it go forward with this clarifying amendment on it or not, I think is the real question. And then we'll have a vote on whether the bill itself ought to go forward. So to Senator Goodwin's amendment, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No. No.
Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer, to the bill.
Yes, to the bill, Mr. Chair. On the 10% factor of adjusting to either compensate for whatever the HOA would require when one of these solar systems are installed, what would that 10% represent in real dollars so we know what we're talking about?
Mr. Abbey.
Chair, Senator Limmer, thank you. At today's prices, you might be paying, as a residential homeowner, $5 per watt. Typical Minnesota home, 5 kilowatts would be could fit on a suburban home roof, and would also approximately cover the energy needs for your house for a year, if you're a typical house. And so 5,000-watt system at $5 a watt would be about $25,000. 10% would allow the HOA to increase the cost by up to $2,500 or more if it was found reasonable.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Lemmer.
Just so I'm aware of the I have more of a backdrop question. How many years do you have to have a system to compensate for $25,000 of upfront cost? That's a lot of hot water to heat up to get that balance out of it.
Mr. Abbey.
Chair, Senator Lemmer. I should clarify, that's for a solar photovoltaic system. Yeah. Solar hot water is typically not going to be that expensive, and solar hot water traditionally does have a faster payback. In terms of the solar PV system, which might cost $25,000 or more, you know, there are different ways to look at the payback. Granite countertops. Some people would say that pays back when you sell the home in terms of resale saleability. But also with new financing options that are coming online for solar, in some states, not just Minnesota, but in some states, we've seen it where your system actually pays for itself, your cash flow positive on day one. And the system costs need to continue to come down for us to get to that point here in Minnesota, I think. But there's good reason to think with the 2013 legislation and continuing market development that these systems are going to be quite popular and affordable.
All right, to the bill. Any further discussion? Is there a motion?
I'll make a motion, Mr. Chair. On the motion that Senate File 2525, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to. Don't know where it's being referred to.
All right. Senator Goodwin moves that Senate File 2555, as amended, be recommended to pass and be sent to be referred to the Committee on Environment and Energy. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
No.
Motion does not prevail.
Division?
Does not prevail.
It does not prevail.
Sorry. Okay, division has been called.
I'll call
all
for division.
All those in favor raise their right hand. Right hand. All those opposed? The motion does not prevail on a tie vote.
Senator Latz.
Senator Sharon.
May I just would like to say to the author that I might feel differently about this if it would dealt with all new developments and all new townhome associations. But to change the rules on an existing association is difficult for me to come to. People develop under certain rules, agreements, and regulations, and I am inclined to honor that. I have through all of my elected office at city council level as well. So,
Mr. Chair, thank you.
Senator Eaton, thank you. We're going to return to Senate File 2175, Senator Bonhoff's bill. We've been informed that Commerce Committee is not requesting to see the bill, so it needs to go to Finance. So Senator Newman will renew his motion that Senate File 2175, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Finance Committee.
So moved.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. We're going to jump around a second because we have to get one bill out to meet deadline for sure today, and the Senator Reinert's bill on Senate File 2028. Senator Reinert, present. Senator Reinert is not present, then we cannot go forward with his bill.
Did you see that?
All right. If someone wants to notify Senator Reinert, we'll take it up when he gets here after we've completed whatever bill we are on. Senator Eaton, Senate File 2733.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. 2733 is A bill that allows neuroleptic medications to be administered if the patient's been prescribed them but lacks the capacity to consent, so they can continue to give the medications while they're getting consent. And I'll have Dr. Pratt will clarify.
Thank you
Dr.
very much.
Dr. Pratt, welcome.
Mr. Chair. Yes, this allows for the continuation of neuroleptic or antipsychotic medication that has been prescribed to a patient prior to their admission to a state facility. And then once they are admitted, the medication can continue, even when the person lacks decision-making capacity, until such time as we can obtain consent from the court. This only applies in the instance when the person is not refusing the medication. And so under the current statute, we have to stop the medication, get court authorization, and then restart it.
So, Dr. Pratt, I'm reading the bill here. And it does not, from its language, appear to restrict its application to those patients that are newly admitted to the hospital and are arriving with a prescription already in place, unless this section fits in a larger statute that says something to that effect.
No, that is it. It is a very limited circumstance, and right now the statute requires us to stop the medication, seek court authorization before we can restart it.
I'm going to ask Council to take a look at this, because if I'm looking at line 1.15, it just says the patient has been prescribed neuroleptic medication. It doesn't specify when that prescription was entered. So theoretically, at least the way I'm reading this, a patient who's been in the hospital for 6 months gets a prescription during that 6 months in the hospital, and then they stop agreeing to take the medication, that you could continue the medication without getting a Jarvis order. Am I reading this correctly?
That is not the intent, and if we did not make the language clear enough, my apologies, and we can hopefully correct that. But the intent is that when a person is prescribed medication that they are willing to take prior to admission to a state facility and then enter the state facility, continue to be willing to take the medication, but are assessed as lacking decision-making capacity, that we would be allowed to continue it until we get court authorization.
Mr. Chair?
It says upon admission.
Does that cover it?
It says upon admission.
Just the placement of the language.
Senator Letts, it says upon admission.
Yeah, Senator Sharon. Yeah, we're looking at that to see if the placement of that place in the sentence addresses the concern.
Or, Mr. Chair, you could, alternatively, you could say the patient has previously been prescribed.
Another idea.
I always put the upon admission at the beginning of the sentence. Then if the patient has previously been.
Pontius, would you please read a proposed amendment to clarify that sentence?
Mr. Chairman, on page 1, line 15, after medication, insert prior to admission to the treatment facility.
And delete the
And then delete. Upon admission to the treatment facility on 16 and 17. I'm trying.
Mr. Chair, I think it's important.
And is being admitted or something.
I think it's important that it's restricted to state facilities.
Does this whole section apply only to state facilities?
Yes, sir.
So you're saying that, in fact, it does apply only to state facilities, and you're just explaining that as comfort for us? Or are you saying that
I just understood her to say that it would be any treatment facility.
Yeah, only treatment.
Well, the treatment facility is already referred to in your bill.
Okay.
Is that referring to more than just state facilities?
Not
your bill, does your bill apply only to state facilities?
Agency bill. I'm assuming it applies only to state facilities.
I would think that's a defined term in Chapter 253B.
Okay.
So, Senator Goodman moves the amendment as Ms. Pontius described. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted.
Mr. Chair,
Senator
I have a
Goodman.
Quick question. Again, I like this bill. It probably would be a good idea to, and I'm not going to make an amendment or say we can do that here, but I just want you to think about this, that we could also make this apply to jails and prisons. Because currently the issue is when people get arrested or whatever, they don't often have the medication. They have a mental illness. They don't often have the medication that they had been taking. And then as they sit in jail, they get sicker and sicker and sicker. So we can talk about that later, but it would be probably a good idea to include that at some point here.
Was there any further discussion? Senator Goodman, did you get your concern addressed?
Yes, I did. Thank you.
Okay. And Dr. Pratt, I understand this temporary permission. I'm sorry, I mentioned Jarvis order for those who, I know those on Health and Human Services are probably familiar with it, but it's the court order to force neuroleptic medications on non-consenting patients who lack capacity and need the medication.
Yes, in this case, when the person is agreeing to take it, the court appoints a substitute decision maker rather than granting Jarvis authority.
Admission to a treatment facility.
But this temporary order would only apply, or this temporary authorization would only apply for 14 days?
That's in keeping with the current statutory language, which says that we have, when we file, when there's an emergency now and we start emergency forced medications, we have 14 days to petition the court. If we get that petition in front of the court within those 14 days, they assign a hearing date, and then the status of being able to continue the medication continues from day 14 through the date of the first hearing.
Then how does a substitute decision maker fit in?
A substitute decision maker is assigned when a person is not refusing the medications but they lack decision-making capacity. Then the court appoints a substitute decision maker who consents on behalf of the patient. That process is a quicker, more streamlined process than having the court determine that Jarvis authority is warranted.
We had signed up an Amanda Kelly. Do you wish to be heard on this or just available to answer questions? Department of Human Services?
Amanda Kelly works with me, and she's not able to be here.
Okay. Anyone else in the room wish to be heard in connection with this bill? Any questions, comments, discussions? Senator Newman.
Just a couple questions, if I may, Mr. Chairman. I'm not familiar with the term substitute decision maker appointed by the court. If you know, Mr. Chairman, or if anyone else in the room knows, are we dealing with someone who is under guardianship?
Dr. Pratt?
Mr. Chair, Senator Newman, no. Probably not, though that could be the case. By and large, guardianship does not cover the ability to consent to antipsychotic or neuroleptic medication. So we need a separate court action for that class of medications that a guardian is not typically given the capacity or to consent to on behalf of the patient. But most of the time, they're not people who have guardians. Their status of not having decision-making capacity is usually temporary, based on acute mental illness that is impairing their thought process.
Okay. And Mr. Chairman.
Senator Newman.
Maybe Ms. Pontius can help me on line 121, 122. Makes reference to subdivision 6. Where is that? Maybe I'm misreading things, but I'm not seeing subdivision 6.
Senator Newman, there's no amendment proposed to subdivision 6, so it's not part of the bill. You'd have to go back to the statute.
Oh, very good. And then one final.
But we do have the information
okay.
for you. Council's right on
Mr.
top of your
Chairman,
question.
Senator Newman.
Thank you.
Well, this is it's in the same section. There's a whole section of law dealing with neuroleptic medication, and sub 6 deals with patients without capacity to make informed decisions and then the appointment of a substitute decision maker specifically for that purpose. So there's a process there. And I can give you a copy of it if you'd like to look at it.
No, that's fine. And Mr. Chairman, Ms. Pontius, this appointment of a substitute decision maker is going to occur, by the court with notice, a hearing, that type of thing. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, it says the court shall appoint a substitute decision maker, but a hearing's not required. And then it specifies who that person has to be.
So the whole, Ms. Pontius, the whole subdivision describes the criteria and the process for obtaining that substitution decision maker, and it's just a cross-reference process that's in the bill that's before us.
Okay, and I don't intend to go through that whole statute. I'm just trying to understand. One final question, if I might,
Senator Newman.
To the author. The bill has in it its section 2, the pilot program. Is that still in the bill? And if I may, Mr. Chairman, either to the author or the doctor, it strikes me as being somewhat odd to have a pilot program involved when medication is being administered to patients, particularly when they apparently don't have the ability to consent. I mean, it seems to me that it's either a good idea to have these folks receive the medication or it's not. It almost strikes me as like we're running a test case. Could you explain to me the rationale as to why we would have a pilot program rather than just deal with this statewide because it's a very good idea?
Dr. Pratt, could you explain what Section 2 applies to?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Newman. These are two separate pieces of legislation. I'm not sure exactly how they got incorporated into the same bill, but the second piece about the pilot program does not have anything to do with medications. What it has to do with is that right now when people are committed, they're committed to often committed to the commissioner of the Department of Human Services, but placed in a non-state operated facility, and the commissioner is never notified, but the commissioner is responsible. And so what this is doing is saying we need to have a pilot program in which the commissioner is notified in all cases of commitment to the commissioner so that we can look for opportunities for early intervention to see if there's an outcome that we can achieve other than commitment and to make sure that the person is being treated in the most optimal facility. We're proposing it as a pilot rather than for all 87 counties because we're not sure what the volume will be, and we're wanting to start to process this, what volume of information is there, what resources do we need to work with to address these issues before requiring it across the system. And so that's why it's a pilot.
Thank you, Doctor. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right, any further discussion of Senate File 2733?
I'll move Senate File 2733.
Okay, Senator Sharon moves that Senate File 2733 as amended be recommended to pass and be sent to the Senate floor. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails.
Senator Eaton, please stay. I would like to make a motion to reconsider Senate File 2555.
Senator Sharon moves to reconsider Senate File 2555. This motion may be made by any member of the committee. And so the question before the body, the committee, is whether or not to reconsider Senate File 2555. And if the decision is to reconsider it, then the bill will be back before the committee for further discussion, amendment, and vote. So this is, I believe, a debatable motion, isn't it? To reconsider?
I think so.
Senator Sharon, would you like to describe your purpose?
My final statement, it dawned on me that I could have offered an amendment that would have brought my vote in a positive way to this bill. So I'm asking for reconsideration to offer the amendment to the bill for your consideration, and if it passes, then we can vote on the bill and I'd be able to support it. If the author accepts the amendment.
Mr. Chair, I would have been grateful for that opportunity.
All right. So any further discussion on the motion to reconsider? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. Senate File 2555 is back before the Judiciary Committee. Senator Sharon.
Thank you. As I indicated, the difficulty I have with the bill is that it is not proscriptive, meaning going forward. So I've offered, I would like to offer an amendment. I don't know if the language I offered has been formed into good language, but in essence what it does is indicate that the contents of this legislation and as it's written would apply to future private entities or homeowner associations that form after January 1st, 2015. Something like that. Were you able to fix my language by any chance?
Ms. Fani.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sharon, I think on page 2, after line 25, just insert effective date. And had this section is effective January 1, 2015, and applies to common interest communities or residential communities created on or after that date.
That is my motion, and I would hope that you'd accept that as a friendly motion.
Senator Eaton.
Mr. Chair, I have one of the parties involved here would like to speak to that.
Sir.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is John Burns, and I'm attorney, and I represent Fresh Energy. And I apologize that I'm the only one here left to testify. And specifically to that amendment, Fresh Energy, the advocate, would support that. However, Senator Sharon, we wonder if you would consider modifying your amendment to say that it would affect homeowners associations that do not have this in effect as of March 1st. Otherwise, there's 1,000 associations which do not have it currently in their homeowners association documents and certainly could change that prohibition. I'm not sure if that was your intent of the amendment or not.
Mr. Burns, counsel is asking, that don't have what in effect as of March 1st?
Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Our preference would be at Fresh Energy that the prohibition go forward for new homeowners associations that are built, but not for homeowners associations that are in place now. We would prefer that if they don't have it in their organization documents, that they not be able to pass a resolution to their association documents adding this prohibition. Meaning, and there are a few, we've been told, that currently have the prohibition in place now. And if that's the intent of Senator Sharon, is that if they have this already in their rules, no solar, We can accept that they not be affected, but we would prefer, if the chair, if Senator Sherman would be okay, that if you don't have a rule in place, you not be able to go add one that prohibits all solar.
I would prefer somebody else offer that as an additional amendment. I think that still would be problematic for me in terms of people getting the information and understanding the implications of what this is going, what's going into this legislation for those that are currently in these kinds of agreements. So my amendment, I would prefer to keep as it is, and if others want to offer alternatives to that, they can. But this is my intent, my offer.
Senator Sherman, I think one of the questions would be, ultimately, would you vote for such an amendment if that additional provision was added? Because that's
no.
The bottom line where we're
that's bottom line is
going
no.
Here. So.
No,
Mr. Chair.
All right, Senator Eaton.
I would like to accept Senator Sharon's amendment.
Yeah,
friendly.
Mr. Chair, I was going to say I don't think anything would prevent them from putting this this in their association documents. I don't think they'd have to have special language to do it just because they're not under. You know, I know what I mean. I mean, if they want to do it, they can do it. If they want to add in their documents that you know they support solar energy or whatever, they can do that.
I think Mr. Burns' point was for those who don't say anything in their
documents,
in their rules
that,
right now, that they not be able to go in after the fact.
Now oh, I see
and,
what you
and
mean.
Enact an outright prohibition
yeah,
on
yeah.
solar.
Okay.
And Senator Sharon is not comfortable
right.
with that at this point. So I think that's sort of the bottom line right now in this committee.
Okay.
Any further discussion on Senator Sharon's amendment? Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Sharon, help me understand your amendment. In the future, if there is an existing homeowner association that does not have Senator Eaton's provision in it, they would have it in it if this bill passes.
No.
Is that what you're saying?
Senator Sharon or Senator Limmer, no, they would not be affected by this bill at all. It would only be newly formed homeowners associations after January 1, 2015, would be
right.
subject to the conditions and provisions in
okay.
this bill.
And so, Mr. Chair, if we pass the bill with the Sharon amendment, that would mean that are we installing this language as a requirement or at least the conditions in a requirement for every homeowner association in the future? Despite the fact that it may not be specifically written into their contract and the consumer would not know.
Yes, subject to subdivision 3, which means single-family dwellings attached or detached where the dwelling owner is responsible for insurance and maintenance under all those processes. So it wouldn't apply to condominiums, for example. The roof is commonly owned. Is that correct, Ms. Pontius? Okay. Any further questions?
Sharon, was my characterization correct?
Put the conditions after it's going to happen.
I'm not sure if you're.
I hope you don't ask me to repeat what I said.
Yes. this amendment's intent is to implement what's requested by the author in future formed homeowner associations or private entities.
And Mr. Chair,
Senator Limmer,
there could be a possibility, a very real possibility, that an HOA. Bylaws, guidelines, their constitution of their association not have this provision in it. So the owners would not know there is a provision, despite the fact that it's now written to be proscriptive. The homeowners may still not know that they have this. That this law would be a trumping of their homeowner association. So I don't think it's a whole lot different than what Senator Eaton has, other than his existing associations, and the new existing associations won't have knowledge of it either.
Senator Latz, I've been a part of a homeowners association, and I assure you that in the development of those, that you use legal expertise that needs to know all of the laws that are applicable to the development of those associations. And if not, I think the association or any member there would have a legitimate complaint about the organization.
Mr. Chair,
the legal assistance that they've been given on that association. I certainly would take them to task.
Senator Limmer. Senator Sharon, you have more confidence in homeowner associations than I do. Having 35 years of selling product, there is a lot of vagaries in homeowner association contracts. And over time, they don't seem to be getting better. And so I just think we have a different time span that you're recognizing, but it really doesn't change the concerns that you had in your opposition to the bill.
Senator Limmer, we have lots of state regulations that apply to homeowners associations. And whenever they're formed, they're held to those state statutes, whether they know about it specifically or not. And this would just become one more of those requirements to understand at its formation. Senator Limmer.
There happens to be a townhouse association in the very south end of Hopkins. You might be familiar with it. It was an association that did not collect reserves to anticipate the repair of roofs, siding, windows, asphalt driveways 20 years after they were built. Now, that contract was following existing state law. But due to the fact that they had not prepared for it, they didn't ask for a reserve to be collected. 20 years later, the roofs, the asphalt driveways, the windows, the seals on those properties all went bad at the very same time.
All right. Senator Limmer, I'd rather not get into a discussion of all the ways in which HOAs have failed to follow state law. That's been in existence for decades.
Senator
So Lott. Let's make a
it's
decision. Let's move on. We still have a lot of other bills to deal with today.
I'll move the bill. 2555 as amended.
Senator Sharon.
We have to have the amendment first.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
All those in favor of Senator Sharon's amendment say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. On the bill as amended, Senator Goodwin moves that Senate File 2555 as amended be recommended to pass. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. All right.
Thank you very much.
Senator Reiner. You know, we still have to get to another committee this deadline week, so we're going to bring up Senate File 5. Item number 5 on the agenda, Senate File 2028. And then after that, we're going to do Senate File 2423, Senator Goodwin's bill. I'm sorry for items 6 through 8 on the agenda. It looks like unless these other bills go faster than I think they will, we're not going to get to them today, and they'll be first up on the agenda on Thursday at noon. You're welcome to wait around for another 20 minutes and see if we get to them, however. I'm okay extending our coverage today a little bit past 2:30 to try to get to what we can, but these other two, we do have to get done today. Senator Reiner, Senate File 2028, please give us a one-minute summary of your bill, and then we'll focus on the provisions specific to this committee. I'm going to remind members that most of what's in Senator Reiner's bill we've already addressed in Senator Rosen's bill last week. There are two sections of Senator Reiner's bill that are new to this committee, sections 7 and 9, and so I'd like to focus our attention on those sections, please. Senator Reiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And there's an A4 author's amendment. I'm wondering if you would like to put that on first so we can focus on those two sections you mentioned.
Okay, members, you have the A4 amendment in your packet. Counsel Backus, if we put on the A4 amendment, does that, just so the committee knows, other than sections 7 and 9, does it provide the same content that was in Senator Rosen's bill last week?
Mr. Chair and members, yes. There's also section 10, which isn't in our jurisdiction. It's an appropriation. But those three sections would be the new ones. And then the rest of the bill of the amendment would be substantively identical to provisions in Senator Rosen's bill from last Friday.
All right. This being the first. Well, no, we've got a second stop. So this is technically not an author's amendment. This is a substantive amendment. We need to know exactly what the amendment does before we can consider it. Senator Reiner?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The A4 amendment essentially does three things. It as counsel has mentioned, lines it up with the provisions that are in the omnibus, but the pharmacy board bill that Senator Rosen is carrying, the couple new sections which you have highlighted for the committee are provisions that are currently in the House bill. We're trying to line the two bills up to not have a conference committee, and so those are the ones that you have highlighted. Those are essentially the two substantive things that the amendment does. So it includes the provisions in Senator Rosen's bill, and it includes a couple new provisions that are currently in the House bill, which has gone through the committee process. But
which
in the House.
Does what, Senator Reiner?
The two provisions that are in the amendment that are new to the bill from the House bill are sections 9. There's one small amendment, one small change in Section 7 that changes statement of identity to statement of ingredients, which is actually an important change. That was an issue we saw repeatedly with our store in Duluth, the last place on earth, with the statement of ingredients or not having a statement of ingredients. And then Section 9 is some language around restitution that if business or individual is selling products under false pretenses, that there is recourse to go after those folks to pay restitution for costs incurred in prosecuting those cases. So, and Mr. Chair, if you want me to, I can point to the other places, but it's as such, that's where it's the Board of Pharmacy language, and Mr. Weiberg can maybe speak to that more succinctly than I can.
Well, Senator Reiner, we addressed everything other than Section 9 extensively.
Right.
Senator Rosen heard the bill. I do not wish to go over it again.
That's fine with me, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. But as for Section 9, I have a question either for you, Senator Reiner, or for counsel. This is a mandatory restitution order, and it looks from the language here like it is broader than potentially broader than what is typical as a restitution order in a criminal case, because it doesn't limit itself to out-of-pocket costs. It says all reasonable costs incurred by public and private entities and the medical costs of persons. So I'm not clear if someone's medical costs are covered by insurance. Is that intended to be part of the restitution order? And then the question for counsel really is, do we have in place statutes that mandate restitution as a part of a sentence, or is that typically left at the discretion of a judge?
Oversight?
Maybe answer that second question first.
Mr. Chair, members, as to the second question, it's relatively rare in statute that we require restitution like this. We do have a few instances, though, generally dealing with either service animal crimes or public safety animal type crimes, and we also have it for identity theft. And those are the only, there may be a couple others, but those are the ones I'm aware of.
So, Senator Reinert, to that question and the other one.
Mr. Chair, I don't feel strongly about Section 9. I do feel strongly about representing the work of my House member, Representative Simonson, who chaired the House's Select Committee on this issue and spent the interim working on it. So, you know, my amendment reflects the version of his bill now, but far be it from me to suggest that the Senate should just adopt House language as is.
Let's take it out.
Well stated, Senator Reinert. You've walked both sides of that very well. Senator Champion?
Mr. Chair, I just feel sort of strongly about Section 9, especially when you take away judicial discretion and for an opportunity for a person to be heard on this matter, making it mandatory, and then it's so vague when you think in terms of the reasonable costs incurred by the public and private entities that provided an emergency response to a person who consumed the substance. I just think it's so vague and it's outside of the bounds of what the court would right now allow. What happens in a situation where a person doesn't have insurance? Then will we have the county sort of pull all these costs together and say, here's what we as a county or tier one hospital paid for this person? What if the person had a pre-existing condition. I mean, I'm not quite sure how far we're going to go, and especially with this language, it says mandatory. So therefore, you're handcuffing any decision maker as to what those costs should be.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Reiner,
thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Champion. I feel strongly about moving this bill forward. I don't feel strongly about this section. If a member of this committee wanted to take Section 9 out, I don't think, and Dr. Weiberg and I have been chatting, it still gets us where we substantially need to go. We'll have a conference committee, but I'm sure Senator Newman will join me. He knows as much about this issue as I do. He was our Senate author when the Republicans were in the majority, and I very much appreciate his work on it. So
with that, Mr. Chair, I would move to delete Section 9.
Senator Champion moves to...
Mr. Chair, I don't think we've moved the A4.
Yeah, has anyone moved the A4 amendment yet? Senator Goodwin, did you already?
Nope.
I'm trying to think procedurally. Okay, so Senator Champion will move adoption of the A4 amendment without the language in Section 9.
Yes, that is my motion, Mr. Chair.
Any further discussion on that amendment? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Is there any further discussion on the A4 amendment, which now for new purposes contains Section 7, the one change on line 27 of page 6, and Section 10, which is a human services finance question that will be dealt with by a different committee. Seeing no further discussion, Senator Champion moves that Senate file 2028 as amended be recommended to pass and be...
May I speak?
I'm sorry. Yes, I apologize. I should have asked. Anyone else in the audience wish to be heard on this bill? Come on forward if you'd like to testify. Please state your name for the record. And if there's a sign-up sheet or board line around here somewhere, please sign it.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee,
sir.
My name is Curtis Hanna, KURTISHANNA. I have a couple of comments about this bill. I apologize for not having been to the hearing a couple of weeks ago related to this issue. I did want to first point out, speaking of trying to have this in a form that is similar to the House committee, that I was in, I believe it was the Judiciary Finance Committee just last week, and Section 712 through Section 720 was actually removed from the House version of the larger 50-page Board of Pharmacy bill at that hearing, after hearing a couple comments that I had spoken about. One of the main concerns that I have regarding this section is the fact that it removes oversight of the Board of Pharmacy from a large number of different entities. First off, individuals are not currently able to petition the Board of Pharmacy to remove substances from Schedule 1. Other than individuals, groups of individuals, when the board seeks to go through the process of expediting the rule change to put something into Schedule 1, groups of individuals are not able to send letters to the Board of Pharmacy to request a public hearing, which I believe is a very valuable thing for our society to have, public oversight. And also, it removes legislative oversight by removing the need for the Board of Pharmacy to tell members of committees in the legislature the actions that they are going forward with. I also would like to mention the fact that no individual is able to remove any substance from Schedule 1. And so if the legislature desires to give the Board of Pharmacy expedited rule change abilities, the legislature ought to know that it is the legislature's ability only to remove these substances. And so if there is no process for the board to alert the legislature about what substances currently have accepted medical use in the United States, that is definitely a problem, because the definition of a Schedule I substance is that it does not currently have accepted medical use in the United States. The Board of Pharmacy used to have the duty to annually review every single substance in the Controlled Substance Act to see if it currently is properly scheduled, and they lobbied the legislature through a previous bill to remove their need to look over these substances yearly, which also causes a constitutional issue, because one could argue that this is arbitrary and capricious to have these substances in there without an annual review to determine whether they are properly scheduled.
So, Mr. Hanna, if I understand your concern, you got two concerns. One is the board's authority in the first place to schedule substances under rulemaking authority.
Expedited rulemaking,
I'm sorry,
Mr. Chairman.
Expedited rulemaking authority, which is already in law.
But will sunset, Mr. Chairman.
But the current law sunsets it at a certain provision. And the second concern is that the legislature isn't specifically notified when substances are added to the schedule in that matter.
Yes, those are definitely two great concerns. And the third, which I have already spoken about, is that the Board of Pharmacy may not remove any substance from Schedule I and is not does not have any duty to alert the legislature that some substances should be removed from Schedule I because they do now have accepted medical use. And that was a result of a petition that I sent to the Board of Pharmacy to remove a substance from Schedule I, and they successfully lobbied the legislature within a couple weeks after that petition to remove their authority. And the reasoning that I got was that they are such a small agency that they did not want to take such a large act as to remove a substance from Schedule I. But that is very much the complete opposite of what it seems like this bill and the 50-page bill, which the Board of Pharmacy is presenting this year, seems to be talking about, where they have the authority to cease and desist individuals that are in possession or selling substances. And the other concern is that the definition of drug is extremely concerning. It says that a drug shall also mean any compound, substance, or derivative that is not approved for human consumption by the USDEA. So in essence, every single substance in the cosmos will be defined as a drug if this is to pass, and the Board of Pharmacy is able to issue a cease and desist order on anyone that possesses a drug or sells it. And this sounds like hyperbole, but it specifically mentions that this includes common household preparations and chemicals sold exclusively for non-medical uses. And this includes drugs, chemicals that are related to the arts, it related to pesticides, related to flavoring extracts, toilet articles, cosmetics, perfumes, spices, and other commonly used household articles.
Mr. Hanna, you didn't read the rest of that sentence on page one.
I did.
When the compound is introduced into the body, induces an effect similar to that of a Schedule I or II controlled substance listed in our schedules.
Mr. Chairman, that's actually
a significant restriction.
Actually, that's after the word or, and so it does stand on its own, the first sentence or the first section of that paragraph. The section that you are referring to is that if state law allows this for human consumption, it is then deemed still to be a drug if it has a effect on the body similar to an analog of a Schedule I or Schedule II substance, which seems like I'm in the movie Inception or something. It's anything that has an effect similar to an analog of a Schedule I substance. We're getting into derivative of derivatives here, which seems to be a violation of the void for vagueness constitutional provision.
All right. Any further questions for Mr.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Goodwin.
No, I think he's right on that. This is very broad language. And on 5.34, it says whether or not the substance is marketed for the purpose of humor, consumption.
Why don't we ask counsel for a legal interpretation of the application of that provision?
And Mr. Chair, Dr. Weiberg could.
Senator Reiner?
Might I respond?
Dr. Weiberg.
I'm Dr. Cody Weiberg. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Pharmacy. I'd just like to respond to this a little bit because some of the I know Mr. Hanna is quite sincere. I've been dealing with him for several years, but he just has some mistaken assumptions that he's just given the committee. First, I'd like to mention that the substance Mr. Hanna asked the board to remove from Schedule 1 was marijuana. And the response that I gave to him was not that the agency was too small to do that. What I pointed out to him in a detailed letter that was sent to him is that removing marijuana from Schedule 1 was problematic for the board for several reasons. First of all, I pointed out...
Mr. Weiberg, I'm not sure that this committee needs to get into the reasons why you responded to Mr. Hanna in any particular
way. Okay, that's fine.
Let's focus on the provisions that...
Okay, if I can just make one point then. I'll get out of that reason, but I'll just get to the point that I was making there.
Yes.
The point that I was making, the ultimate point, is that if any state agency, if any state government entity was going to put the state of Minnesota in direct violation of federal law, it should not be an administrative agency like the Board of Pharmacy. It should be the legislature and the governor. That is what the basic message was about that issue. In terms of the rulemaking process, and you may all be very well aware of this, but under the expedited rulemaking process, under any rulemaking process, there's a requirement under Chapter 14 and the rules promulgated thereunder for the agency that does the rulemaking to notify the chairs and ranking minority members of all the relevant committees. In addition, there's a separate subdivision in Chapter 152.02 that directs the Board of Pharmacy to report to the legislature every December on any changes it makes to the controlled substance schedules. So, in fact, it is simply not true that the board would have no obligation to notify the legislature about what it's done.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Weiber. Any questions or comments or discussion from members of the committee? Anyone else in the room wish to be heard on this bill? Mr. Backus has a suggestion for clarifying the language that Mr. Hanna addressed to make clear that the "and" provision applies to both subordinate clauses preceding it.
Mr. Chair, members, I was just going to suggest, and this would have to be done in a few places in the bill, but if the committee were to insert a comma after law on 1.12 and then make the same change on line 3.28, 4.6, and 5.16, and perhaps if you can direct me if there's any other place to add it, I can add it afterwards. But I think the addition of the comma, I think, would better set that off to make it, as you said, that it would apply to both clauses.
Senator Reiner, Mr. Weiberg, does that work for you?
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Weiberg.
I'm not 100% sure, but I think that comma might actually be in the House version, I believe. So, yes, it'd be fine.
All right. Senator Goodwin moves the addition of the commas in the places that Mr. Backus recommended and any other places in the bill that it needs to be done to affect that intent. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Any further questions or discussion? Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And you may not want us to go here, but I'm going to take I do have a question under.
Do I have a choice?
yeah, you do. under section 2 on page 1, Mr. Weiberg. There's a provision that is being created for cease and desist orders. Am I correct that the board did not have the authority or currently does not have the authority to issue cease and desist orders?
Mr. Chair, Senator Newman, that is correct.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Newman.
On line 1.24, it says, whenever it appears to the board. What is the standard that the board would be using in order to make the determination that a cease and desist order would be appropriate?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Weber.
Senator Newman. Just one thing first. The board actually worked with the Attorney General's office on this language. It actually came from the Attorney General's office, and they tell me that they modeled this after language that the Commerce Department has. But in terms of what the board would do, how we envision this would happen is we currently become aware of these sort of substances when we're either contacted by a law enforcement agency or by a county attorney's office. At that point, when we're alerted that a particular store might be selling these products, we would need to know. We essentially need to have a sample of that product analyzed to determine what's in it. If we actually argue believe that the current definition of a drug makes these substances that are being sold, as they were being sold up in Duluth, a drug, but with this clarified language, it certainly means it's going to be a drug. And the Board of Pharmacy for probably 50 or 60 years has had the authority to go into any establishment in the state from which drugs are sold and to pay for and get samples. So under that existing authority, if we're notified by law enforcement or a county attorney, we would go in. We would get a sample. We would have it tested. I was thinking it was going to be the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. It turns out they cannot look at civil cases like this would be, so we're going to have to contract with a private lab. If, in fact, it turns out to be a substance that would fit the definition of a drug, at that point, then we would work on issuing the cease and desist order.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Newman.
Dr. Weiberg, you know, I appreciate the explanation very much, and I have no doubt that that is what that the board would want to proceed along the lines that you have just described. But given the fact that we are dealing with new authority being granted to the board in the form of a cease and desist order, it really seems to me that the language, whenever it appears to the board, is some really ambiguous, loose language that does not provide any legal guidance as to the standard that the board would utilize in determining when to use a cease and desist order. And I will tell you that, you know, I'm not real comfortable with it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the indulgence.
All right, any further discussion? Senator Goodwin moves that Senate File 2028 as amended. Be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on State and Local Government. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
The chair is in doubt. All those in favor raise your hand. All those in favor raise their hand. Of Senator Goodwin, it's your motion. Are you voting on this?
Oh, yeah. I suppose I should vote for it. I don't really like that much.
All those opposed, raise your hand. The motion prevails. 5-3.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee.
All right. Senate File 2423, Senator Goodwin.
24.
If I wasn't clear before, items 6 through 8 on the calendar will not be addressed today on the agenda. I apologize to those who've been waiting. We'll deal with those first up on Thursday at noon.
Mr. Chair and members.
Senator Goodwin.
Senate File 2423 is a bill that basically sets out some provisions for how to deal with pregnant women and when they're incarcerated. We've had some ups and downs on this bill, but now we've got agreement from all the parties, so it shouldn't take too long here. I've got an amendment. It's the A5 amendment. Don't know if members have it yet.
Okay. Let's take a look. Do we have an A5 amendment in the packet?
Right. And I have a couple of changes.
It's being handed out right now.
I have a couple of changes to make to that amendment, too.
All right, well, let's get it handed out first. Senator Goodwin.
Okay. On the amendment, first I want to make a couple changes. On 2.11, delete the semicolon and add unless inmate refuses the test.
All right. Senator Goodwin,
a couple more. Up there. I need to change
after age insert unless the inmate refuses the test. Okay, Senator Goodwin?
Yes, and then on line 2.18, after the word charge, add to the correctional facility.
To the correctional facility.
And one more on line 2.19. Strike the word the and add the word certified doula, D-O-U-L-A. And then follows, it, services is fine. Leave that there. And the semicolon too. So those are the changes to my amendment. Now, the delete everything amendment is been worked on by
Senator
everybody.
Senator Goodwin, this is an author's amendment. Senator Goodwin moves adoption of the A5 amendment with her amendments. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails, amendments adopted. Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, so now what this bill actually does is it sets up some requirements for the way that pregnant women can be restrained and when they are at certain times of their pregnancy. And we have now the agreement of the Sheriff's Association that had some issues with it because we've made their corrections, the changes. We have the support of MCCL, who delivered a letter which should be handed out. We have the support of the Department of Corrections, and we the bill is brought to us by the Children's Defense Fund. So everybody is in agreement with the changes that we've made here, and I don't think it should be controversial. The language that on the restraints is taken right out of the Sheriff's Association handbook because they actually had better language than we had in our original bill. So this word for word what the sheriffs have in their handbook on the use of restraints. And then I'll let Ms. Anderson say a few words about the bill, and then we can just vote on it.
Okay, and actually, I believe the Executive Director of Children's Defense Fund will first speak before me.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Peggy Flanagan. I'm the Executive Director of Children's Defense Fund Minnesota, and I'm also here as a mom. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today in support of this bill, and thank you to Senator Goodwin for bringing this bill forward. Additionally, I wanted to thank Senators Lori, Rosen, and Johnson for signing on to this bill. This legislation is endorsed, as Senator Goodwin said, by several organizations, including the Second Chance Coalition, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, Minnesota Citizens Concerned for Life, the Minnesota Better Birth Coalition, and, of course, Children's Defense Fund, where we support policies and programs to improve child well-being exactly as this bill would do. We know that a child's lifelong well-being begins in the first stages of life with its mother, but babies born to incarcerated women are much more likely to suffer from poor outcomes because of their mother's pregnancies, are often high risk and compromised by a number of variables. This bill would help to improve birth outcomes and promote the lifelong health and wellness of babies born to incarcerated pregnant women by providing the women access to evidence-based care, treatment, and education. It is so important that the legislature pass these basic standards that Senator Goodwin is proposing to make sure that they are included in facility policies. It's also critical to have them apply to all correctional facilities across the state to ensure consistency so that no matter where a pregnant woman is incarcerated, her baby is given the chance for a healthy beginning in life. Our legislative associate, Jessica Anderson, will walk us through the provisions of the bill, and then with your and Senator Goodwin's permission, we would like to offer Erica Garrity of ISIS Rising Prison Doula Project and Dr. Katie Kazimanel of the University of Minnesota the opportunity to testify as well. Thank you.
Thank you. As you know, we're past our usual committee time, so please only the testimony that you think is necessary to convince the committee to pass your bill.
Okay.
Thank you. Quickly as possible.
Okay. I'll talk fast. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for having me here today. My name is Jessica Anderson. I'll briefly walk through the provisions of the bill just because I do think it is important to understand what is in it. Section 1, definitions, I'll just point out two in particular that members might not be familiar with if they haven't been involved extensively in childbirth. Doula services has implies continuous emotional and physical support throughout labor and birth and during the prenatal and postpartum periods. And then postpartum means the period of time following the birth of an infant to 6 months after the birth. The next section pertaining to restraints would limit the use of restraints on pregnant and postpartum women to ensure the safety and health of both mother and baby. These restraints are often unnecessary due to the fact that females tend to be nonviolent offenders, and restraints come with dangerous health and safety risks to mother and child. I'll add that federal courts have interpreted the use of restraints to be in violation of the Eighth Amendment, and 18 other states have also passed legislation limiting their use because they also feel that policies alone may be insufficient. Currently, DOC policy limits the use of restraints. Counties may also limit them, and as Senator Goodwin said, our language actually stems from county law enforcement. This provision would prohibit the use of restraints on women known to be pregnant during labor and delivery, and also within 3 days of giving birth, unless there is a legitimate security or safety concern. It would prohibit the use of dangerous waist chains and handcuffs behind the back. And when restraints are necessary, they must be the least restrictive available. Then there's also a training requirement just to ensure that officers understand the use on these women. The next section, the third section, pertains to standards of care and education for women and girls who are held beyond a certain period of time, because we didn't want this to necessarily apply to every single woman who is brought in and is just there for, you know, an hour perhaps. So this applies to women who are incarcerated following conviction, and then also women who are incarcerated before conviction but beyond the period specified for their initial appearance before the court. So my understanding is that might be like a woman who can't make bail. Proper care and education of the mother is vital to positive birth outcomes in the infant's lifelong health and wellness. Currently, DOC has policies similar to the provisions laid out in this section. While jail policies or practices may contain some of these provisions to varying degrees but not others. And we want a law, again, to require these standards to make sure that they are included in facility policy or continue to be included if they're already there in the interest of the baby's health and well-being. So more specifically, and as you can see in Section 3 of the bill, subdivision 2, point number 1, tested for pregnancy if under 50 years of age. 84% of incarcerated women's pregnancies are unplanned. And there is a tremendous risk to mother, baby, and actually even the facility if they don't know whether or not an inmate is pregnant. So it's imperative that they identify those who are. And this is current DOC policy. My understanding is that jails require the woman to request the test, so we would rather that the onus be on the facility than the woman. And let's see, number 2, if pregnant, tested for STDs, including HIV, and again, that would be contingent upon the woman's agreement. As you may know, complications can arise in pregnancy due to infections left untreated, so we would like this to apply across the state as well. Number 3, if pregnant or given birth within the past 6 weeks, we would want these women to have appropriate educational materials and resources related to pregnancy, childbirth, breastfeeding, and parenting. And educational materials equip women with the information they need to be healthy mothers who develop and raise healthy babies. Remember that most of these women will be returning home to raise their children, and we want to elevate their role as mothers because we believe that that will benefit their child's well-being. It may even strengthen their attachment to their child, which is shown to reduce recidivism. DOC currently provides classes that offers this information. But again, it kind of varies by jail facility as to what is offered. It's my understanding that currently Hennepin and Ramsey County do not provide prenatal or parenting type classes or information. Number four, if pregnant or given birth within the past 6 weeks, has access to services from a certified doula if no charge is brought to the facility. A doula provides support to the mother before, during, and after childbirth and is actually associated with improved outcomes for mother and baby. And one of our testifiers who's here, I'm hoping she'll have the chance to speak, is from the ISIS Rising Prison Doula Project. And they have had tremendous success with this program out at Shakopee Women's Prison. So we, again, would want to see that available to women statewide if the facility is not required to pay for it. Subdivision 2, numbers 5, 6, and 7 apply to mental health. It requires that a woman who is pregnant or who has given birth within the past 6 weeks be given access to a mental health assessment and evidence-based treatment to include psychotropic medications and therapeutic care for postpartum depression. Specifically speaking to depression during pregnancy, it's a risk factor for poor birth outcomes, including low birth weight, preterm birth, preeclampsia, and miscarriage. Following pregnancy, it's a risk factor for a child's socio-emotional and cognitive development. Again, DOC has a
current policy. Ms. Anderson, I'm going to ask you to please wrap it up.
Okay. Yep. All right. Sorry. So
do you want to get to any of the other testifiers, or we're going to adjourn?
Sure. Yep. And then lastly, we have a work group that would be established to consider additional standards, and finally an effective date requirement where it would be DOC starting this year and additional facilities the following year.
Thank you, Ms. Anderson. Yep. Anyone else wish to testify on this bill? I'm informed by other members of the committee that there is no objection and no questions or discussion.
All right. That's helpful.
Then that's the time to vote.
I feel bad because these folks have been sitting here all day. But
I'd be glad to hear
started,
from them. I'd give them 30 seconds each. But
no,
that's,
I get it. If everybody's friendly on this, then we'll just go ahead and move the bill.
I'm sorry amended. For those who came here and have been sitting here all day for this. Bottom line, I guess you want to see the bill pass, right?
Yes, yes. Yes, Mr. Chair. So I'll move the bill. Senate file, remember here, 2423 as amended.
And be sent to the Senate floor.
Yes, sir.
Senator Goodwin so moves. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed. Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
All right, we are adjourned.